last finalist here today. After this session, if you have the time, between 4 and 6, you can actually meet with all the finalists at Peter F. Herring Sling Award stand at D20, David 20, where you can meet with the finalists, you can try, taste their cocktails, and you can also talk to them. And then they will all compete live tonight at 9 o'clock. And Singapore Sling is actually turning 100 years next year, so we are really here to celebrate. We're starting the celebration already now. And the third reason I'm here is, of course, to introduce the author of Imbibe, Punch, the fabulous one and only historian. Please welcome Mr. David Wondrich.
Thank you, Adele. I'd also like to thank my friends at Peter Herring for setting this up and for enabling me to spend 45 minutes talking about one of the more interesting drinks in the history of mixology, the Singapore Sling. And I should also thank you all for being willing to come and sit and listen to 45 minutes about the Singapore Sling. It's only one cocktail. You wouldn't think there would be that much to talk about, and yet there is. Not too long ago, somebody asked me if there was one drink, if I could pick one drink that brought together the whole history of the cocktail, that was typical, that could stand as the typical, the average, the icon, the drink that represents all of mixology. And my initial instinct was to go with, say, the Manhattan or the Martini, but those are really only in a very narrow part of the history. And I thought about it and thought about it and realized that there's no drink that is more representative of the whole broad spectrum of mixology than the Singapore Sling. It's historic, very old, still current. It's still made. It's made in many bars. It's complex and it's strong. It's also refreshing, sometimes fruity. It's a punch, the oldest drink. It qualifies as that. It's a long drink, but it's not too long usually. It has. It's not too diluted. It's classic. It's a tiki drink. It's a pre-prohibition drink. It's a disco drink. It's an Art Deco drink. It fits into all these categories. You can everywhere you look, if you look closely at every category of mixed drinks, you'll find suddenly in the back there's the Singapore Sling waving its hand and saying, "Don't forget about me." It's fascinating. It changes it whenever you look at it. It's like something almost has a life of its own. The story behind it is complex. But wide-ranging, and it begins with punch. In the early 1600s, you had something that could not happen. You had English sailors far from home with no alcohol to drink. They shipped out on their boats from England. For the first time, they started to sail from their far northern climate, where you find England, all the way around Africa, around the bottom of Africa into the Indian Ocean and to India. Before that, English sailors had really only sailed in the north. They sailed from London to Copenhagen, London to Rotterdam, London to French ports on the Bay of Biscay. They were not long-distance sailors, which is fine because each English sailor, by law, was given a gallon of beer. Now, normally a day, every day, you would get essentially 4 liters of beer, except it was actually more than 4 liters because the English measured beer in a different measure than they measured anything else because beer has foam at the top, and none of those sailors wanted the foam to cut into their portion of beer. So a beer gallon was actually 5 quarts, essentially 5 liters rather than 4, just to make sure the sailors didn't get cheated. So these guys were getting up to 10 pints a day of beer. And that was a big part of their diet. And it's still a big part of the English diet. But they get on their boats. Most of the boat is full of barrels of beer. All very good. They start sailing. They're off Spain. They're opening the barrel next time. They're off of the Cape of Gibraltar. They open the barrels. That's fine. Suddenly, they're off the coast of Nigeria and Africa, and they start opening the barrels, and the barrels are not fine at all. All the beer is dead. You know, it was not refrigerated, it was not bottled, it was not pasteurized, it was not sterilized, it was a living beer, and they could not take that kind of heat. And suddenly there's no beer left. The gentlemen, the officers on board, you'd have maybe 120 sailors and 10 officers. Each officer was allowed to bring as much wine as he liked. They had to supply their own. And they'd each bring two or three barrels for these voyages. Unfortunately, two or three barrels of wine lasts fine for one man. It does not last fine if you're sharing it out to the whole crew. And suddenly, there's nothing to drink. And the sailors are very unhappy. So at one point, somebody, we don't know who, came up with the idea of taking the little barrels they kept on board of spirits, of eau de vie, of aquavitae, as they called it, distilled spirits, made from grain, grapes, whatever they had. Somebody took that and mixed it with water and citrus juice and sugar and a little bit of spice to restore everything that had been distilled away when they turned the wine or whatever into spirits. So they put in the juice to restore the acidity, the water to restore the water, of course, the sugar to restore the sweetness of the grapes. And suddenly they have a balanced, drinkable drink that they could make under local conditions. You could buy citrus juice, citrus fruit anywhere. You could pick it up along the coast of the Indian Ocean. It grows wild. It's easily available. Sugar keeps forever. Spirits keep forever. Actually, they have food to keep them. Water they can get. And so suddenly they start making, sometime around the very first decade of the 1600s, they start making this drink called punch. And it becomes the sailor's drink. Lovely drink. It was the first popular drink in the world made with spirits, the oldest drink made with spirits. So spreads from the English sailors to the Dutch sailors. The sailors go back to Amsterdam, they go back to London, they get on new ships, they go to the Caribbean this time, suddenly punches in the Caribbean. Eventually it spreads all around the world. It becomes the global sailor's drink. From there it spreads to London, it's a little bit less to Amsterdam, but London it becomes the new drink of the late 1600s. And everybody's drinking it, it's hideously popular, expensive, a bit of a luxury drink, but quite wonderful. So all well and good if you're in London. London, you can get lemons, you can get limes. They're shipped right up from Spain. They're expensive, they cost about the equivalent of €5 each. But you can still get them. However, if you're in Scotland or in the inland parts of North America, the new English colonies over in North America, if you're in New Hampshire and it's wintertime, you have a severe problem when it comes to getting citrus. You can't get lemons, you can't get limes, you can't get anything. If you're on the west coast of Scotland, if you're in Ireland in the winter, this stuff doesn't grow on trees there. So they start to make adaptations to the recipe. We're in the middle of the 1700s. In Scotland, they leave out the citrus. They use hot water and spirits and sugar and maybe a little bit of spice, all the other ingredients of punch. And they call this toddy. And hot toddy becomes very popular. In the Americas, in the American colonies, we call it instead sling, because you sling one back, throw this drink back, and we don't make it in the big bowl like they do in Scotland. We make it one glass at a time. And this becomes one of the earliest American drinks. You start seeing it in the 1780s, right after the American Revolution. people are drinking ginseng. That was basically Geneva. We drank in America, we drank Dutch-style gin. New York had been a Dutch colony for quite some time. That was how the gin we knew how to make, and we made a pretty reasonable imitation of Dutch gin. And if we were rich, we imported the stuff straight from Schiedam, Rotterdam, and Amsterdam. So you take that, you take some sugar, some water, maybe a little nutmeg, and this one addition that made American drinks conquer the world. The one thing we had in America a lot of that other people really didn't have was ice. We had, at that point, maybe not anymore, clean lakes, clean ponds, clean rivers, with no development around them, with no factories on them. We have a strange climate in North America and the East Coast. We have very cold winters and very hot summers. So the very cold winters mean that the lakes freeze, and you can cut the ice up into blocks and put them in warehouses packed in sawdust so they don't melt. And in the summers, you can sell them for money, because everybody who's ever been to America in the summer appreciates an ice drink. The climate is hot, humid, and very unpleasant. And so by the roughly 1800s, we start seeing ice coming more and more into American drinks. And this idea of the ice gin sling spreads all over the United States. The new country becomes one of the canonical American drinks. If you put bitters in it, it becomes a cocktail. If you leave the bitters out, it's a sling. Some people prefer the sling, others the cocktail. Spreads everywhere along with the cocktails and the julep and one or two other drinks. Indeed, by 1840, you start seeing it popping up in Europe as this new style of Yankee drink. Because every traveler who comes to America looked at their country, they looked at this new country, they found the people were rude, the people had no culture, they sat with their feet up on tables, they spit tobacco juice everywhere, they had no respect for their social superiors, their diet was poor, it was bacon, it was corn, Indian corn, maize, it was game animals, we ate bear, we ate turtles and pigeons and all these strange animals. And we just didn't behave in a civilized manner. The place was dirty, the service was bad. Everybody was miserable when they came to America. The climate was hot in the summer and cold in the winter, as I said. However, during those hot summers, there was one thing that even the most critical travelers agreed on. We knew how to make great drinks. They go home, they write books of travel, you know, travel accounts, long books about how awful things were in America and how bad the Americans were. And then they'd say, well, except on a hot day, there's nothing like a mint julep or a gin sling, an ice gin sling, to cool you off. And in this, we have to admit the Americans are ahead of us, but only this. So these American drinks start getting back to Europe. And the Europeans, especially the English, have a little bit of trouble with them at first. They don't understand these drinks. Punch, of course, they understand, but they usually make it in a big bowl. They don't make it by the glass. They're not used to mixing drinks by the glass individually for each person. That's a little strange. They think that because it's American, it must be a very, I don't know, a vulgar drink. A somewhat cheap and unpleasant drink. And they start playing around with the formula. You see that in 1861, Charles Francatelli, the Queen Victoria's cook, publishes a cooking book, and he has a gin sling in there of this radical and novel that he has to drink. He says you have to drink it about out of a straw. And he writes a whole paragraph on how strange it is to drink out of straws. Because in America, we drank out of straws. We didn't want to get the ice on our teeth. And England, they didn't really have the ice, so they didn't need to worry about their teeth. They didn't drink the cold drinks, so the straw was a little strange. And in his slang, he puts in the usual gin, except he's using English gin, the usual sugar, except he puts in several slices of lemon. You know, in America, we didn't put lemon in the slang. If you put lemon in, that made it a punch. It was a glass of punch. We were very firm about these things. We had our categories of drinks, and if it was one, it wasn't the other. It helped that we had lots of German immigrants by the 1850s who helped us to really put things in the right categories and start organizing this strange body of knowledge that is the American drink. So Francatelli starts with this. 1869, you see William Tarrington writes a very influential drink book, and he includes a whiskey sling that has not a bunch of slices of lemon, but lemon and orange juice in it, lots of citrus juice. So you start seeing the English making changes. Meanwhile, you know, in America, we're strictly the gin sling. Is no citrus of any kind. The first American cocktail book comes out in 1862, written by a former sailor, Jerry Thomas. And he has a whole category of slings, and they're very simple drinks, like he would have learned from his ancestors, basically just spirits, sugar, water, ice, that's it. Maybe a little bit of nutmeg on top. But in England, they start blurring the boundaries. Indeed, they start making it almost like the gin punch that has become popular in England. We know that gin punch today as the Tom Collins, but at the time it was the Garrick Club's gin punch or Limmer's Hotel's gin punch, two very similar drinks that were made from gin and sugar and lemon juice, maybe a little splash of liqueur, and some cold soda water to chill it out. Very popular drink over there, and that starts to bleed in with the idea of the gin sling. Throughout the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s, this drink tends to evolve. At first, the English considered there was nothing more vulgar than the gin sling. It was an American drink. We don't drink that here. And if we do, it's only for the lower classes, the people who don't know any better. No gentleman would drink a gin sling. Okay, maybe that holds true in England. But in the English colonies, things are a little different. In Australia, you have gin sling advertised in all the newspapers from the 1850s on. It goes to some of the other colonies. Eventually, by the end of the century, the gin sling reaches the colony on the Straits of Malacca that comprises of Malaysia and Singapore and a couple of other territories around there. And this starts to get interesting. So, in 1897, we find a Singapore newspaper talking about people who are, quote, seeking slings and dark corners in the morning because they've been drinking all night the night before. And so this sling in Singapore first comes in as a hangover cure, which is another of the categories that the Singapore sling fits into another of the boxes it checks off, the classic of cocktail versatility. Most famous drinks have started in some way as a hangover cure, including the cocktail itself. So the hungover people are seeking slings and dark corners. In 1903, we hear about these same hungover people drinking fizzy wine and pink slings, quote, pink slings for pale people. It wasn't, of course, the native population of Singapore who was drinking slings. It was the colonists, the English, and the other European types who were drinking these things. In 1907, you see it advertised by the Recreation Hotel there. They have gin sling with soda water, gin sling with plain water. The one with soda water costs twice as much as the one with plain water. That's because they were importing the soda water from Japan, and it was a typical Japanese product, expensive, probably well-made, and nice stuff. It's all over the Singapore colony by this point. It's one of the drinks. However, it's still considered a little vulgar, and in 1913, this whole controversy breaks out when the Singapore Cricket Club, the top social organization in the colony, normally refuses to make gin slings at their bar. They're not going to make this drink that has gained immense local popularity because they think it's low class. However, they break their rule for visiting teams with the basic implication being, you know, some visiting cricket team, we have to be good hosts. If they want a gin sling, we'll make it for them. But you know they're not as elegant as we are. You know, they're visiting from Kuala Lumpur or Sydney or something. And those people don't know any better. So we have to stoop and get off our pedestal and make up their gin slings. But for regular members, we're not going to make it. Finally, the younger members put their foot down. And one of the members goes into the club. And he's astonished to see gin slings being served because the visiting team's in town. And then the team leaves. And he says, what can I do to make this happen again? And a couple weeks after this, he goes back in September of 1913. He and his friend, and they walk up to the bar, and they order one cherry brandy, one Benedictine, one gin, one lime juice, some ice, and some water. Now, each measure, the standard measure for spirits in Singapore was 1 ounce, about 30 milliliters. So they get a big glass, and they take their little measures on the bar, put them into the glass together, and make their slings. At this point, the cricket club gives in and starts making slings. Because, okay, we have to, you know. The people are going to be ridiculous about it. But this is the earliest recipe we have for a Singapore sling. So gin, cherry brandy, the gin, probably English style, Old Tom, or even at this point, London Dry Gin. The cherry brandy, we know from that reference to pink slings, it was the red kind, and in fact, the hotel that, what's the name of that hotel again? The hotel that was serving the slings, the recreation hotel, thank you. The recreation hotel was selling Peter Hearing cherry brandy that was on their list. That was the only cherry brandy they had. And so clearly that's what they were using in their slings. And you see it over and over. This is the cherry brandy that's being used in the slings. So we've got the cherry brandy to make it pink. We've got the Benedictine. That turns out to be optional. Other early recipes have maybe, sometimes they have Benedictine, sometimes they don't. The lime juice, sometimes it's lemon juice. So that could change a little bit. The soda water, sometimes it's straight water, plain water. Sometimes, you know, what the hell, it's ginger beer. And so that can change. And you start looking through these early recipes and early descriptions from about 1913 up into the 1920s. And you find out that it was a whole number of different places in Singapore that were serving this drink. They all made it differently, but only slightly. The most famous place that was making it was John Little's. It was a department store. It was the store you went to buy your clothes, to buy your housewares, to buy anything you wanted. But also, at 10 o'clock every day, that was where the businessmen in Singapore met in their, quote, tea room. They called it a tea room. We would call it a bar. And there they had John Little's famous gin sling. And John Little's was famous, you know, it was known throughout the colony as making the best gin sling in the place. Also known, there was Robinson's, another store, also had a strong reputation for their gin sling. Also the Raffles Hotel, Recreation Hotel, several others. The Raffles Hotel had numerous people would knew it for its slings, but it wasn't the, you know, at that point it wasn't the only place. So if you went and went around, and people did this, they'd go around to all the places in Singapore, the Malacca Bathing Club, they might even go over to Kuala Lumpur, where they found them making slings, or up to Shanghai and Hong Kong, where they found them making the same drink, and it spread already. And they found all these minor variations. Some people said early on, no cherry brandy. To make it red, you have to use claret wine. This is sort of the gentleman's approach. Nothing so vulgar as cherry brandy or, to make it pink, you have to use claret wine. That school died out very quickly because with claret wine, it's not a very tasty drink. Eventually, those people learned to compromise and said, okay, yes, cherry brandy, yes, cherry earring, but also the red wine on top. Now, some people like that float on top of the sort of the red wine, but the red wine was too expensive out east, so they replaced it with sloe gin, which is also pink, and they'd get a float of sloe gin on top. Some people believed in ginger beer in this. Some people believed in just mostly sparkling water. Again, the citrus changed. The proportions changed greatly. There was always a good measure of gin in there. The oldest style is the equal parts. Other people kept putting up the gin, which is fairly cheap, and cutting back on the expensive ingredients like Benedictine and even, dare I say, cherry earring. Cherry earring had been imported to the East since the 1840s, if not before, since the very beginning of the company. It was known all over Asia. It was a luxury good in every port in Asia in the late 19th century, actually the mid-19th century. One of the Peter Hearing's captains who was bringing his product around Asia was on the island of Amoy off the coast of China and met by local merchants who hosted him at a dinner. And without him even prompting, they served him cherry earring as this important luxury good. So it was clearly around in Asia. And it became, by 1930, by far the preferred, really there were only two essential ingredients for a Singapore sling, cherry earring and gin. Everything else varied. You usually had citrus in there. Some people only used the peel. Most people used some citrus juice. Most people used club soda if you used ginger beer, like I said. Benedictine, most people liked a little Benedictine in there, and maybe some dashes of Angostura bitters. Some people preferred apricot brandy or even orange Curacao or Cointreau in there. So you see this, it's almost a cloud of recipes. They agree, they differ. In the 1930s, the premier American drinks writer, this man, G. Selmer Faulkner, an interesting guy, he had a daily drinks column that he ran for 8 years, 6 days a week, writing a column that you can only imagine the amount of work that took to do everyday drinks. But his column printed a lot of letters. So if you print a recipe, people would write in. And a lot of people knew Singapore well from back in the days. In the 1930s, somebody who had been traveling for 30 years was in Singapore in 1900 and knew how things were. So his letters column is a goldmine of drinks history. And all these people wrote in about the Singapore sling. He must have written 10 or 15 columns on it, including new information for people. And the one thing they all agree upon is the cherry brandy is essential and the gin. The other things you really see is vast variation. So it's already kind of a cloud. World War II happens, comes about, sweeps through Singapore, English thrown out, rapids closed, Japanese officers there. Everything is completely suspended for 4 years. And when things come back, Singapore, it takes a while to get up and running again. It's pretty tough. By the 1950s, you start seeing more economic activity, you start seeing advertisements in papers, you start seeing new hotels, you start seeing cherry earring ads in the Singapore papers, giving the classic recipe for the sling with cherry herring, lime juice, gin, etc. And that seems to be what everybody was making in the hotels. If you look at some of the new hotels in 1954, Lim Jit Bu, a Chinese barman at the modern Seaview Hotel, the newest and fanciest hotel in town, is making an absolutely orthodox Singapore sling with the cherry brandy, the Benedictine, etc., the gin, but also a little float of claret wine. This kind of brings us around to the Raffles version. Now, we know that early on, the Raffles version, there are a couple different recipes from the Raffles Hotel. The best one was one contributed to a drinks book that came out right after the war by this guy, John Kelly, who wrote this very rare book published in Honolulu in 1948 called Be Your Own Bartender. John Kelly had been a liquor importer in Shanghai before the war. And then, you know, the Japanese swept through Shanghai. He had to get out. He settled in Hawaii. And after the war, he publishes his list of recipes that he had, including all these recipes from hotels and other places in the East before World War II, including the British Raffles Hotel, as he calls it, and their recipe for the Singapore sling. 8 ounce Collins glass, half full of ice, juice of half a lime, 1.5 ounces of cherry brandy, 1.5 ounces of London dry gin, and then he floats slow gin on the top. Maybe, you know, instead of the claret, he uses the Japanese 10-sen aaron, the Japanese fizz water, decorates it, this is what they were doing rather at the Raffles. They decorate it with a slice of, quote, spiced citron. I'm not sure exactly where they were getting the citrons from and how they spiced it, but that was their characteristic garnish. And so this is sort of the pre-war drink. After the war in the 1950s, you find Raffles making the same drink, basically, until the early 1970s. Now, in 1967, a man by the name of Roberto Pregars, an Italian, takes over management of the hotel. The hotel had pretty much fallen on hard times. They hadn't modernized it, they hadn't renovated it, they hadn't kept up with the times. And Roberto Pregars is one of those genius hotel men who really wants to fix this. And he takes over this old hotel, and he starts trying to fix it, In 1972, the old owners decide to sell it. First they wanted to tear it down, and the Singapore government was in favor of tearing it down. But they decided to sell it to him instead. He came up with investors, he made them a good offer, and so they sold it to him, and he had to do everything he could to keep the place alive. First thing he did, what's your main engine of profitability in a hotel? The bar. He increased the size of the bar, he moved it into a bigger room, he called it the long bar. And then, Pregars was not afraid of monkeying with history in the interests of economics. He changed, or as he says, improved the gin sling. The first thing he seems to have done is come up with an inventor for it. Because suddenly, in the early 1970s, you start hearing about this gentleman, Yam Tong Boon, the head bartender of the Raffles Hotel in 1915, according to Roberto Pregars. I've never been able to find anything from 1915 with Mr. Boon in it. It's possible. It's possible he was the head barman there. There's nothing to say he wasn't, but as we can see, the drink is considerably older than 1915. But he may have had the dream, fair enough. In also when
Vergaris comes up with this story and puts it out and starts putting it into the publicity for the hotel, he comes up with a slightly new formula. The drink is one part gin, one half part cherry herring, one half part mixed orange, lime, and pineapple juice, and then some soda water. Just slightly changing the balance a little bit, letting some pineapple in there. Oh, and then a dash of Cointreau. You first start seeing this recipe starts getting reported in the mid-1970s when travelers go there. In 1973, 1974, you start seeing it coming up. That splash of pineapple juice would keep expanding and expanding and expanding over the years. Not only in the hands of the Raffles Hotel, but everywhere the Singapore Sling is served. You have to remember, it was the 1970s. The original Singapore Sling formula is very booze forward. I mean, most of the stuff that's in it is gin. Cherry Herring is not weak. Benedictine is not weak. Angostura bitter is boozy. A little bit of soda water and some lime juice. It's a fairly austere drink. It's not a tropical drink as we understand it. So to add that little bit of pineapple juice and then let it expand in the 1970s was survival. The hotel wouldn't have been there without the bar. The bar wouldn't have been there without the Sling. Whether he dug it out of an old recipe that the hotel had and then improved it, he admitted to improving it, we don't know how he improved it. Whether that was his improvement or he just found an old recipe, we don't know. And in a way, it really doesn't matter, because when you look back on the Sling, you see that it's not like the, everybody knows what goes into a dry martini. There are two ingredients, three at the most. You know, a dry martini is gin, vermouth, orange bitters if you're in 1910 and you're making them, a bit of lemon peel or an olive, you know, that's it. There's nothing else that goes in there. The Singapore Sling, even in its early days, the gin slings in the East had this sense of possibility, the sense that it was a class of drinks that every person who made them was going to make them a little bit differently. When Selma Fogner was collecting recipes in the 1940s, he collected at least 10 or 12, all from reputable sources. One was from the Met Hostess in Malaysia, one was from Raffles, one was from the Malacca Straits Swimming Club, one was from John Little's famous department store. So these places all have provenance. They're all equally good as the other. I mean, who's to say that this place has a better recipe than that? They all come back to pretty much the same time and the same place. And it puts the Singapore Sling in this unique position of being a drink that is open. You know, it's substitutable. It's almost a class of drinks rather than one drink. Which brings me, let me see how I'm doing on time here actually. Oh yeah, we're doing good. This brings me to the Sling Awards 2014. So, the history of the Sling is not a closed history. It's open-ended, of course. There are many, many different ways to write yourself into this history. For all year, Peter Herring has been collecting entries in this Sling Around the World contest, the Peter Herring Sling Award 2014, challenging bartenders all around the world to come up with the best variation of the Sling, the best new member of this Sling cloud, let's say. 2,000 entrants for a cocktail contest, that's a huge number. That is very rare to get that many. 44 countries, equally rare. Cherry Herring, Peter Herring being a maritime company, has been global since the earliest days of their history, since the 1820s, 1810s. They've been all around the world, and they still are. It took a distinguished jury, Dale DeGroff, Steve Olson, Simon Gifford, all these people all around the world. Jeffrey Rosengart, thank God for coming, thank you. All these really distinguished judges to wade through this 2,000 entries and come down to five finalists. Five is an awesome number of finalists to have in a cocktail contest because it's really intense when there are five. You can't hide. Everybody is up there. Everybody gets full attention. So we have Sigrid Saar from Estonia. We have Aron Manzanillo from the Raffles Hotel. Thank you very much. We've got John Krause from New York, in the USA, of course. We've got Tufik Zrafi from Montreal, soon to be Toronto. And we have Nick Hovind from Copenhagen, all competing tonight. Now, an important part of this contest is the audience vote. The audience vote counts as an extra judge here. If, when this is over here, you go out that door into the main hall and make a left and go down to the end of this main hall, on the right you'll find the chair hearing booth, and there you can taste all five entries, all five drinks, and please do this and please vote on them, because those votes will be tallied. The voting closes at 6 o'clock, is that right? 6 o'clock? Yep. And then we will reconvene at 8 o'clock at the Fragrance Bar at the Ritz-Carlton for the finals, which should be fun, and like I said, intense with some extremely serious competition, and we will try to obviously succeed in writing in the next chapter in this tangled history of the Singapore Sling. This should be very fun. I guess that's pretty much the end of my prepared remarks here, but I have a couple minutes for questions if anybody has any on any of this stuff, and we will proceed from there. Yeah. Tom Collins is a punch because it has citrus, it has spirits, it has sweetness in it. It's the first punch with sparkling water in it. It's the first punch that's primarily served in a glass. Invented, as far as we can tell, by this guy Stephen Price, who wasn't American. He was a theatrical manager in New York. And in 1828, he went over to London to manage a theater, and then that theater failed. And he took over the Garrick Club, and he was manager there. That club is still there today. A very fancy club for actors and gentlemen. And he was always drinking this punch that was made with chilled soda water. And so this is really the beginning of iced punch, of cold punch. And it starts coming around as Garrick Club punch. From there it goes to Limmer's Hotel. From there it goes back across to America as the John Collins and then the Tom Collins. Ah, well, it has maraschino in the original recipe, which counts as a spice. You know, it's all you need is another modifier in there. Also, the early punch recipes, spice was optional. If you had lemons and sugar and a nice bottle of rum and some water and you didn't have any nutmeg, you weren't going to cancel a perfectly good punch party for the lack of nutmeg. You would go ahead and enjoy yourself. Other questions? All right then, well thank you very much, and I'll see you all later, I hope.